Ladies and gentlemen, I noted with approval, indeed with delight, that Professor Thunby distinguished between the symposium proper and the present occasion. I am, as it were, delivering the opening improper for this meeting, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity of speaking to a more general audience than the, at least I hope you are a more general audience, than the highly specialized ladies and gentlemen who will be meeting in the seminar room next door, because they scare the pants off me. They're dealing with things that are way beyond my own work, and I'm here to learn, not to contribute to that. My theme, the announced theme, the place of corpus study in linguistic research, is one which, you know, would have been controversial a few years ago. One that would not have been controversial, let us say, 25 years ago, but 15 years ago, was indeed very controversial indeed. And I would like to draw the attention of everyone here present to a book that's appeared this year. If you could take down the reference, I think it hasn't actually been published in this country. At least I learned to my surprise last night that not everyone who would want to see the book has in fact seen it. It's edited, it's in German, it's edited by H. Bergenholz and B. Schäder, and it's called Empirische Textwissenschaft. Empirische Textwissenschaft, published in Königstein in Hessen, 1979. Bergenholz and Schäder. It's a collection of essays, mostly in German, but with several articles, that is to say the German ones concern on the whole German corpora, and several of the articles deal with English corpora, and some of the participants here today are represented in that volume. I can see at least three in this present audience. And I want to draw attention in particular to the article by Bjarne Ulvestad, who is the professor, I don't need to tell you, the professor of German in this university, and to our distinguished colleague at this seminar, Nelson Francis, who talks about the Brown corpus and the beginnings of that corpus in there. And there's a paper also by Professor Svatvik and myself on the corpus that that I'm really talking about today. So that if I open more seams than I mine in the course of the next hour, perhaps you'd be good enough to sort of follow up the this talk through that volume, which certainly very usefully brings together an enormous amount of the stuff that we are having in this symposium, we're having to take for granted. We're having to sort of go on from there. As the sort of old man of the group, the one that began the survey of English usage in collaboration with Jan Ruszewski from Warsaw, who was here today, we began the survey of English usage back in 1959, as the old man of the group, I'm not expected, fortunately, to have access to all the modern technologies that Professor Ella Gordon, Mrs. Leach, and people like that have at their fingertips. And so I'm just giving this improper opening on the kind of background. But I was struck by the fact that in this volume, Bergenholz and Schäder, both Ulvestad and Francis began with a reference to a gentleman one time at the University of Illinois, now at the University of Tel Aviv, called Robert B. Lees. And Ulvestad draws attention to the burst of contempt for corpus study that erupted in 1957, and to which Robert B. Lees speedily gave a classic expression. Expression in words which, whatever their liberating effect was, their liberating and I think revolutionary effect was 20-odd years ago, and I must say I share some of the feeling for that revolutionary effect. Whatever the effect was then, they've come to have an increasingly hollow ring over the years, because to Bob Lees, the corpus man was merely a pre-scientific dull cataloguer of data. Oh, you see, it's true up to a point, you know. He's got a point. And that this was marked off from the brilliant scientist, and these parts, the parts that I stress are in quotes, who exercised flashes of insight. Now, Nelson Francis, in this volume, recalls that the same Master Lees told him in 1962, when Nelson Francis was scratching around the States trying to raise money to launch the Brown Corpus, which we now regard as, you know, the sort of bedrock of computational corpus analysis. He was scratching around, raising money for this, and Lees said to him, "What on earth for?" And Francis told him, and Lees looked at him in utter amazement and said, "That's a complete waste of your time. You are a native speaker of English. In 10 minutes, you can produce more illustrations of any point in English grammar than you will find in many millions of words of random text." You know, the story is told that Noah Webster was once caught in a compromising situation with his maid. "Mr. Webster," said his aggrieved wife, "you have surprised me." "No, Mrs. Webster," said Noah, "it is you that have surprised me." Now, it is not recorded what Nelson Francis said to Bob Lees on this occasion, but he would certainly not have been surprised in either the sense intended by Mrs. Webster or Mr. Webster. We, however, would not be surprised if Nelson's reply had been, "We need a corpus to escape the subjectivity of introspection." Write to him now, Nelson. Now, of course, this wasn't new. The escape, the will to escape from subjectivity was by no means new in linguistic science when the modern scientific corpora started up. And I want to make a sharp distinction here, and it may be an over-sharp distinction, between the type of data orientation in linguistic work that was going on before our corpora began in the late 50s, and what has now developed and what has become virtually axiomatic in corpus-based linguistics. Everything depends on two crucial factors, so it seems to me. One, how we select the data that we are going to be dully cataloguing. And secondly, whether we subject those data, that data, according to which side of the Massachusetts Avenue you come from, whether we subject the data to the golden rule of total accountability. Because, you see, we often speak of the great giants of the past, Jespersen, Kreisinger, the editors of the OED, as being corpus-based. But when all honor is done to these giants, and it is almost impossible to do adequate honor to those giants, there are no such giants around today. These were Ibsens among the Stoppards and Akeborns of the present. When all honour is done to these giants, there was, in fact, a casual, eclectic assembly of material that they were using, not corpora in our modern sense. And what is more, the eclectically assembled data were not subjected to total accountability, but only used to provide what seemed to them the highlights, which were then subjected to description. So I would like to say a word about the selection and the coverage of material in the modern corpora. And it is a fact that all of the modern corpuses, which we are going to be discussing here, and which are discussed in this volume, Empirische Textwissenschaft, always lay down very precisely what the goal of the particular corpus is, how it was selected, what its limitations, what its known limitations are as a representation of the particular population of which it is to be a representation. On the handout that you've been given, at the top of the sort of family tree side, you see that there are three types of data which are represented in the corpus of the Survey of English Usage, which in many ways is the most Catholic of the corpora that are in existence. That is to say, we have attempted to cover in that what we refer to rather pompously as a representation of the repertoire, the total repertoire of the mature educated native speaker. That is to say, in respect of anything that guy can be involved in, from chatting informally to his family, to giving a learned paper at a Royal Society meeting, to issuing judgment from the bench, to drafting a statute itself. The whole range of what a mature native speaker could be involved in is what we try to capture, not just printed English, not just spoken English, but, as it were, the lot. And that was, of course, a fairly easy decision to arrive at, and it was one of the few ways in which it was manifest to all that in the 1950s, linguists were able to get at new data, because, of course, the cheap electronic recording of speech became possible only, not with the beginning of sound recording in the 19th century, around 1880, but only with the evolution of first the wire and then the tape recorder in the 40s and early 50s, so that for the first time the linguist was able to get at, as it were, real speech. So, okay, obviously we're going to take that in. But then there had to be decisions about how much of this material one would take, and what categories of different types of material one would take. On the verso, on the other side, no, this page 2 is in the form that you've got it, page 2 of this handout, you can see how we have decided to share out the material. And this was done after months and months of seminars took place to identify the parameters affecting linguistic variation within the individual, that is to say, interpersonal relations, the type of subject matter that's being handled, and so on, so that we could set up a priori varieties of English in which significant concentrations of grammatical phenomena occurred that could be regarded as typical. For example, I say this in hesitation in the presence of Professor Svatvik, who is the world expert on the passive, the tendency to use the non-agential passive in scientific description, such as And the expression, a change of colour was observed at 300 degrees Celsius. It's a hackneyed type of example, but it's in fact valid. Now, while repeated sampling and argumentation could establish that linguistic conventions can be identified within a broad band of so-called scientific description, it appeared to us that only lexical items made the more specific distinctions between, let's say, engineering, physics, and botany. And thus, no grammatical grounds existed within the overall limits of about a million-word corpus for setting up these as subcategories in the corpus. On the other hand, having found evidence in style and grammar for setting up a category of newspaper English, the seminars that we held further established comparable grounds for distinguishing between the language of news gathering, or news reporting, from other types of press material, for example, sport and fashion reporting. We decided to introduce a category, creative writing in prose, after a great deal of soul searching, because although it's essentially fictional prose is essentially mimetic of potentially all the other varieties of a language, since, of course, within fiction we may be involved in fictive scientific discourse, legal argument, and so on and so on, and, of course, putative conversation. It can quite easily be demonstrated that there are numbers of conventions in fiction as a whole to justify regarding this as having the characteristics of a variety of English in its own right. Well, it became clear that as well as distinguishing between material originating on paper, whether for delivery on the stage, or whether for reading as a private letter, or the hearing as news report, as well as distinguishing between material arising on paper and that originating in speech, written material was often sharply different in print as compared with the relatively uninstitutionalized forms adopted in personal composition, whether typed or handwritten. And the seminars that we held were able to establish that while letters on social matters obviously differed from those on non-social matters, business letters, letters to the taxman, and so on, the grammar in both categories varied sharply according to the personal relations that were in existence between the writer and the recipient. And three points in an essentially gradient relation were set up in consequence. Participants, both in speech and in personal communication, were regarded as on an intimate footing and an equal footing or on a distant footing in relation to each other. And similarly, the gradient between intimacy and distance was found to affect very strikingly the type of language used not only in ordinary face-to-face conversation, but in unseen participant conversation, as over the telephone, and perhaps above all in the new type of telephone medium that arose during the 1960s, the answer phone service, which is increasingly used by business organizations, medical practitioners, and so on. Another important factor, obviously, as we most of us in this audience will know, was the presence of a microphone, which moved speakers in the direction of careful formal speech, i.e. in the direction of regarding the someone in the audience as being in a distant relationship. That little microphone was potentially distant, see, even though you might be speaking to a friend at the time. Various factors of this kind enabled us to set up the very inadequate, but we hope reasonably faithful, set of varieties that we have distinguished on page 2 of this document. Now, having fully argued out the varieties that must be represented in the corpus, it was quite another matter to decide how much out of a finite body of material, let us say a million words, how much we should take from each of those types of material. Now, in Professor Francis's paper in the Begenholz and Scheder article, he mentions, I may just point out that the Brown corpus was set up on very similar lines, and Professor Francis honoured me and a couple of other people like Philip Gove the late and Carroll and a couple of others to go, Henry Kutcherer who is here today as well, to go along to Brown and to pool our resources, pool our brains, we call them euphemistically, in trying to work out how to set up the Brown corpus. And we did it on similar lines because, of course, I in London was able to represent our mistakes and failings and methodologies. And in this article, Professor Francis comments on objections that had been raised, very interesting objections that had been raised to the constitution of the Brown corpus, which is now being used so widely. He said, for example, two periodicals, the Chicago Tribune and the Archives of Neurology, the one a popular newspaper, the other a learned journal, but both obviously in the category of periodical literature, had been selected, had been excerpted on an equal basis. And objectors had said, where's your principle? You know, the readership of the one amounts to millions, and the readership of the other, if the editor's lucky in a given article, amounts to dozens. And therefore, the degree to which they represent the language at the present time is obviously in some sense very different. And Nelson Francis replied to this point that if we had used in designing the Brown corpus, if we'd used that principle of saying, right, let's decide on our varieties, okay, we've done that. Now then, in deciding the size of samples to go for each variety, let us use some kind of populist basis, some kind of representation of degree of common use. Then, said Nelson Francis, it would have so skewed the constitution of the corpus as to have virtually only in it the most popular forms of writing. Well, so too with the Survey of English Usage in London. We decided arbitrarily on a million words. I mean, the decision on a million words has got nothing to do with linguistics. It's got to do with money and time and the life of the human individual, which, as you see, is sort of running out in some of us pretty rapidly. We decided then to sort of put a cut down the middle, half speech, half writing material. A quarter of the material as a whole would be printed, and about a fifth would be written material that was intended for spoken delivery. Now, if our scaling of the survey texts had been related to language use, then it would have been reasonable to have said, okay, 99.9% of the corpus must be devoted to speech and 0.1% to writing. Even those of us who write a fair amount, still speak 99% of the time as compared with writing. So the half that we currently have of speech was itself shared out not on a populist basis, but on a linguistic basis. Ranges over the various forms that unscripted speech can take, from solemn monologue commenting, let's say, on a state funeral, through careful disputation in a law court, through technical discussion of scientific research, to informal banter between friends at dinner. And clearly, if the selection had been on the basis of estimates of language use, even within speech, then we would have made that informal bantering talk between friends overwhelmingly predominant. We did not, and we think that we are right in not doing. Now, that is all I'm going to say about the selection of the corpus, but I'd like to turn now to the other point that I made, or what I regard as being vitally important in the use of corpus, and that is the subjection of the data to total accountability. And it seems to me that this is perhaps not always given clear expression when we're talking about corpus work, but is certainly implicit in all of the corpus work that has been done in the last 20 years, and is certainly absolutely inherent in computational corpus work, where inevitably every single instance of every phenomenon is treated with equal solemnity by the computer. Now, why total accountability? For the very reason, in a way, that Bob Lees and the other early Chomskyites said that corpus was unnecessary, that corpus consists, whether we're talking about manuscript corpus or speech corpus, corpus includes within it a great deal of false starts and anacoluthae, things that the speaker or the writer afterwards rather regrets having said. And it's very easy for the eclectic database linguist to say, oh, well, of course, you know, in charity, I forget that. That'll not go into my grammar. That'll not go into my dictionary. I can see that this is a slip. Now, in fact, of course, many slips in that way are highly significant, highly relevant to the working of the grammar of the language, and indeed of the lexicon if it comes to that, but I'm only concerned with the grammar. And this is another reason, by the way, why print is not enough for good corpus work on natural language. Manuscript, even typescript, is better, because in typescript one can see the false starts, one can see the bits that a good editor, before it would have got into print, would have edited out of existence. I don't have a blackboard, but never mind. Doesn't matter. No. Come on, we can get round this. Let me just give you a pun. No, I would have, but you know, no, not now, Betty. No, come on, no. It doesn't please, it doesn't matter. No, really. No, I only introduced this as a diversionary thing, just to give you a bit of exercise. Look, we can take this in spoken. Listen, somebody writes in a letter, let's say, it is essential that you should come. And when you look at the letter, you see that in front of the should come, there is something that is scratched out. This has actually happened in one of our manuscript letters that we've got on the on file in the survey in London. And when you look at it carefully, you see that what is deleted is just the letter C. It is essential that you should come, right? And one can imagine that a similar thing could occur on tape. It's essential that you should come, right? Now, of course, as we well know, there are two ways of saying such an expression, and it's a Scandinavian flunk, Behrer, that did the great first bit of corpus work upon this. Meditative or polemic should, a monograph that Frank Behrer did some years ago. And here, you see, in this little hesitation, we see that both forms were available to that particular writer, speaker, and having decided, having launched himself on one, he decided to abandon it and go over to the other. Now, of course, in print, that has been obliterated. They wouldn't have seen any trace of that choice that was there. So that what I'm urging is the way in which corpus study nowadays involves us inevitably in this total accountability, because on the machine this has been processed in the case of a computer corpus. This little error is there in the computerized version of the London speech corpus that Professor Svatvik has set up in London at the moment. There's no way that the machine can get round the fact that there was this hiccup over K, and that's got to be accounted for. It's got to set up a theory which will account for that. Of course, I mean, it could be anything. But in this particular case, where there is a grammatical choice between it is essential that you come at once and it's essential that you should come at once, then it's reasonable to say that here is a speaker with access to both constructions who, for some reason or other, prefers the one with should. There are all kinds of ways in which this total accountability process involves and is fruitful of producing material for the analysis of language. For example, there is the one thing which, as I suppose no most dedicated introspectionist would now deny in this decade of discourse analysis, the fact that gradient relations exist in moving from one style to another, and that obviously in the presence of somebody like Professor Ellegaard, who has looked at, as it were, linguistic performance, the distinction between one person's language and another person's language as a mode of putting the sort of fingerprint of authorship upon one rather than another, no one, Chomsky nor anybody else, would ever have denied that it was only through detailed corpus work that this could be done. And of course, again, by the linguist steadfastly refusing, and Anna Zetterstein, whom I see here also, who's also done this kind of work, steadfastly refusing to overlook anything. And it is in this respect that modern corpus studies are so sharply different from, and I would respectfully submit, ahead of these great Greek-like giants of the past, Jespersen and Kreisinger, and Sir James Murray of the OED. Now, I said earlier that when Lees made this point, and Lees and his fellows, it wasn't an entirely vacuous point. And, of course, Nelson Francis would not have denied the truth of it, that he could, indeed, have sat down in his university in Providence, Rhode Island, and have dreamed up dozens more examples of any particular construction than even now he has found in the expensively produced Brown corpus. It is certainly true that while corpus does succeed in helping us escape the subjectivity of introspection, it cannot, but cannot, provide all the data we need for linguistic description. I think the most telling bit of rhetoric that was used in the 1950s, early 1960s, in attacking corpus was that by Noam Chomsky himself, who said that if you took all of the books in the Library of Congress, the largest library in the world, something like 32 million volumes, which no individual in a whole lifetime could, in fact, read, if you took the whole of the printed material in the Library of Congress, there was no guarantee that the following sentence, and you could take any sentence, see, occurred in it. And he regarded this as the great reductio ad absurdum of corpus-based study. And there's something in it. That is to say, after the discipline of accounting for all the data in a given corpus, which must be finite, must really, on the whole, be rather small. After, notice the priorities that I put here, the point in which I am entirely with Bjarne Ulvestad, who's written an article, which I'll turn to in a moment, on a rather similar theme to mine today. After the discipline of accounting for all the data in a given corpus, we must go beyond it. Now, our way on the survey of going beyond the corpus is two ways, one of which we have developed to a very high degree, I think, the other which we use only sporadically, but which is tradition. That is to say, when you get somebody who is working on the accusative and infinitive, let us say, he doesn't just use the Brown corpus, because that has, very interestingly, all the accusative and infinitives that he can then compare in the matrix of all the other kinds of construction that co-occur with it in the language. But it's totally inadequate to write any thesis on the accusative and infinitive based upon the Brown corpus. He then takes text after text after text where he's scanning for only instances of the accusative and infinitive. And of course, being human, he's got to ignore all of those instances where, if he is looking for "she considered him insane," and is taking that as an instance of what he's talking about, he will be ignoring, let us say, "she considered that he was insane," because that is not an instance of the particular thing. So that one can extend the corpus in that way, just looking for the particular instance that you want. The other way is through elicitation. But just as there are two different types of use of corpus, as I've been indicating, the Jespersen way, let us say, and the modern way, so there are different types of elicitation technique. Bjarne Ulvestad, in the paper, in the Begenholz and Scheder article, book that I've been talking about, been mentioning at any rate, contrasts corpus study with introspection. And introspection as a mode of tapping intuition, he subdivides between introspection into the individual, which he calls mono-introspection, and multi-introspection, where the linguist tries to get at the intuition of other people. And Professor Ulvestad has done some experiments with this latter method, multi-introspection, as he calls it. Particularly, of course, as a professor of German, he's been doing it in respect of German grammar during a visit to Germany in 1974-75. And his experiments lead him to the firm conclusion that it is very much inferior to corpus study. And since I want, if my dear friend Betty Sundby will allow me to exceed my time a little bit, I want to advance a really rather different view in respect of techniques that would seem to fall under Ulvestad's multi-introspectional head. I'd like to make the point that his experiments have been on a decidedly different set of premises as to the best way of doing elicitation tests than our own work in London and Wisconsin. In particular, he has used only small groups of subjects. Groups of 10 native informants is what he has been taking, whether on practical grounds or whether for idealized reasons. We shall perhaps hear, since Professor Ulvestad has honored me by coming here this morning. And the other thing is that he has worked only, so far as I can tell from this article, with what we would call the judgment component of our technique, the limitations of which, in isolation, Jan Svatvik and I pointed out in a monograph on the subject back in 1966. And indeed, in reaching his rather low opinion of multi-introspection work, Professor Ulvestad admits that there are flaws in the questionnaire method that he's been using, and that adequate tests, or more adequate tests, as he says, could probably be worked out. And although his overall feeling is very much, I think, in line with my own, that the most, I'm quoting, the most reliable data-gathering method is a combination of the corpus method and the multi-introspectional approach applied in that sequence, his concluding sentence suggests the relatively low value that he places on elicitation material. He says, I'm quoting again, "No speaker and no small group of speakers can reasonably be expected to pass definite judgment with regard to the use of a living language with its truly staggering number of constructional possibilities and impossibilities," which of course is true enough. But this merely indicates that A, small groups of informants, and B, giving only judgments, are in fact a not very adequate representation of the elicitation techniques available today. One might indeed go further and suggest that eliciting judgments alone can't be expected to do more than illustrate one or another aspect of sociolinguistic attitude, perhaps most obviously what Greenbaum and I have called the preceptive usage attitude, which of course has considerable interest in its own right, but precept is well known to be far from practice in linguistic as well as in model affairs, and we would lose sight of its independent value as well as making a rather gross methodological error if we took the one as being isomorphic with the other. Our elicitation techniques are outlined, are summarized on page one of that handout, and I, and since it's all on the printed record as well, you will perhaps forgive me if I don't go into detail as to how those things work at the moment, though both Professor Svatvik and I would be happy to say more about it in discussion or questions that may come up after my talk this morning, if I ever stop. But I would just like to go on to say something else about the relation between corpus and elicitation, because, of course, our focus here in Bergen at the present time is upon the use of corpus. And in his very interesting article in this Bergen-Holtz and Scheder, I bet you've got that reference now, Bergen-Holtz and Scheder, Empirische Textwissenschaft article, Nelson Francis talks about elicitation technique as amounting to what he calls the extended corpus. And I'd just like to look at this a moment, because although this is an ideal situation, I'm not quite sure that we are yet in the position to regard elicitation as tout court the extended corpus. While it is certainly true, to quote Nelson again, that it may be considered an attempt to get at competence more directly than is possible by the description and analysis of even a large sample of performance, that's the end of the Francis quotation, the key word is attempt. And in many respects, our attempts fall short of success at the present time. In particular, our own elicitation techniques fail to match a soundly based corpus in two respects. One, the corpus always contains naturally produced language. And secondly, it provides contextual depth for any phenomenon being investigated. Typically, our elicitation techniques do neither one. It's marvellous. I mean, we're very, very proud of the kind of work we've done with elicitation. For example, let me just give one little example. This is a trivial thing, variant inflections. We all know that there are various verbs like dream and learn, which have got two pasts, dreamed, learned, dreamt, and learnt. And we know also that, broadly speaking, it's the blokes on the other side, the wrong side of the Atlantic, that say learned, and the chaps on the right side of the Atlantic that say, I'm talking at the map, you see, right-hand side, left-hand side, okay? that say learnt and dreamt. But, of course, you know, one can't just say, well, we know this, there's no need to describe it again. So let's look up in our corpora. Well, we were looking last night, and the number of instances of such verbs occurring in a million words are not such that, you know, any statistician, any linguist either, would regard as any ways like adequate to say, well, this is American English, this is British English. And in our corpus in London, we had, in fact, three instances of the past of the verb dream. And indeed, despite the fact that it was all British English, one of them was dreamed and the other two were dreamt. Okay, well, it's whatever it is, you know, 66% T and only 33% D. That's fair enough. Okay, we go ahead with our grammar. Well, we don't work like that, obviously. But if you think of the elicitation method, then you can say, here we've got a group of native English audience, and I say, well, here we're going to do have a little bit of fun with you. We're going to ask you to change various sentences. We may ask you to make a statement into a question. We may ask you to make a positive thing into a negative. We give examples of each of these processes, but we're talking in ordinary language grammar. And then we say, he loves his daughter. Make this past, and everybody writes down, he loved his daughter. Easy, right? And then we come to the thing, I often dream of eagles. And make that past, everybody writes down. Everybody writes down whatever form comes natural to him, right? But of course, it is out of context. And he certainly isn't writing natural language in the way that he would be if he was suddenly talking about his own dreams. You know? He is performing an unnatural linguistic act, as it were, in public, what is more. sorry about that. Yeah. Okay. But nonetheless, suddenly, you see, whereas your corpus before had three instances of the past of dream, you've now got 53 instances of the past of dream, and you've got something to work on. So that it builds up data, but in general it doesn't give you this very good contextualization. We have, in fact, developed techniques which are marvelous for the individual sentence, but which are not good for the discourse. And we are working on various ideas that we have for being able to get at this, but we haven't made too much progress so far. But in the last couple of minutes that I'm going to be talking to you, I thought that I would give you a quick rundown on some of the current work that Ruzhetsky and I have been doing in the last 3-4 months in London, and show you the relation between the corpus and what Nelson Francis has referred to as the attempt to get at the extended corpus through elicitation. In one of the texts applied to Jans Fatvik in Lund, there is a transcription of a phrase, he must have forgotten. And the last part of that is very indistinct. And it is written in the way in which we show indistinctness with double parentheses round the T-E-N part. And the context suggests that this is a bit odd anyway, because it's not the kind of context in which an intransitive or a deleted object forget is going to occur. One would have expected he must have forgotten them. That is what one is. So back on go the headphones, and we listen to this because the transcriber has already shown by his use of double parentheses that he wasn't awful sure. And, you know, when a transcriber is in that position, he goes for the safe bet. He goes for the thing which makes reasonably good grammatical sense. And when we listened to it, we could see his difficulty at once, because really it sounded much more like he must have forgot them. He must have forgot them, which supplies the expected object just where we wanted it, but of course does so with an unexpected, let us say, deviant, perhaps, past participle form of the verb to forget. Well, we said, let's set up a hypothesis. Let's say that it is possible for people to say he has forgot his book. He has forgot his book. And we did various tests of this kind without any success. This year, we did what we call a forced choice selection test with the two... I don't get it now. With two sentences, he must have blank them, and he had blank them. And we asked people to put in either forgot or forgotten into one or other of the slots, but every subject had to use both forms. That is the point of the forced choice selection test. In other words, we're not asking you whether you normally say he had forgot his book. We're saying that in this occasion, mate, you've got no choice, you've got to use it, and the only choice that we can give you is an option as to where you can put it. And it came out with a significant result. We haven't yet done a statistical test on it. But 69 people, as compared with 45, put the forgot form in the modalized perfective. He must have X'd them. There is a single little instance of the way in which some, through total accountability in the corpus, we can get at one, in this case, of course, an extremely minor issue in English grammar. Let me give you just a couple more, maybe. Until. Kerm, in his syntax, mentions no restriction upon the conjunction until in what he calls, very reasonably, abridged clauses. So that although one can have, let's say, after he resigned his office, he enjoyed life. Until he resigned his office, he enjoyed life, both of which make perfectly good sense as to whether you like retiring or don't like retiring, okay? And abridging those clauses, after resigning his office, he enjoyed life. Until resigning his office, he enjoyed life. As I say, Kerm's grammar gives no indication that either one of those is odd as compared with the other. The Grammar of Contemporary English in chapter 11, paragraph 27, says abridged clauses with until are okay if they're past participial clauses, until finished, don't go home, or something of that kind, but not present participle clauses, i.e. not until resigning his office he enjoyed life. And this was challenged, this apparent restriction, well, this explicit restriction upon a particular type of abridgment, was challenged by a foreign correspondent, a scholar well known in EFL teaching, in fact. And so we went to our corpus, and we found, in fact, no examples of until with any form of abridgment, though plenty of the until as a preposition, that is to say, with nominalization, things like until his resignation from office, he enjoyed life. So we tried a simple operation test where all that we asked subjects to do was to replace the conjunction after by the conjunction until. Nothing else you have to do to the sentence. All you have to do is to hear this sentence and then write it out, replacing after by until. And the sentence was, he waited in his office after receiving the message. Now notice there is nothing semantically odd about saying he waited in his office until he had received the message. Right? It's not that the use of until as distinct from after in the semantics of those two clausal relationships is odd. And yet, you see, although asked only to replace after by until, so that it was a very easy job, all you had to do was to put down, he waited in his office until receiving the message. That's all you had to do, just after, until, change to until. There were 55 subjects taking this, doing this experiment, and only 14 of them did that. 41 of them replaced after by until, all right, but they all then made the clause fully finite, until he'd received the message or something of this kind. Now, there was a good instance, you see, in which the corpus was indeed deficient, our Survey of English Usage Corpus, and where, a la Francis, we extended it, as it were, but subject to the limitations that I have just mentioned, that the corpus is natural, whereas these elicitation techniques are not. We've got several other such developments that we've been doing this year, but I'm well aware that I've exceeded my time. I just want to say in conclusion that we've passed the day when we had to justify working on corpus. I am not entirely at one with those who say that the attack upon corpus use was an irrelevant diversion. I think that the attack upon the type of corpus work that had existed in the past was well merited and has done, in fact, corpus work a great deal of good. I think that the corpus work that's going on now is one hell of a lot better than it would have been if we had gone soldiering on with the pre-1955 type of corpus, which was eclectic and which gave very few insights, which had gave us very little attempt or motivation to incorporate many of the insights which the intervening years by the anti-corpus linguists have done. But that quarrel is over, and we are now in a position where, thanks to the great strides that electronic technology has made, where maybe for the first time for 100 years, since the Annus Mirabilis of the Jung Grammatica, we are in a position to harness the energies of a multiplicity of linguistic theories and to make more definitive and more satisfying and publicly justifiable statements about linguistic structure than ever we have done before. Thank you, Professor Sundby.